Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The city has always been a place of expanded economic opportunity over centuries, but that attraction has always been tempered historically by the threat of disease and pandemic. During the 20th century, thanks to modern medicine, the threat of disease waned and cities flourished like never before. But they also became victims of their own success, rising inequality, languishing institutions, skyrocketing housing prices, and gentrification have diminished some of the economic opportunities for those who come to the city seeking a better life. Now, with the threat of pandemic, today with COVID, and other novel pathogens in the future, what's the prognosis for cities? My guest today is Harvard economist David Cutler, a specialist on health and public economics. He and his colleague, Edward Glaser, an urban economist, are the co-authors of Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in an Age of Isolation. The two give an extensive history of urban epidemics, cities remediation, and the inherent inequality of the urban setting, and what cities have done or not done in the past to serve those issues. And they offer prescriptions today moving forward to ameliorate today's situation to restore economic opportunity and a safer city for all. David Cutler is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. David Cutler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure for me to be with you.
Through the last 18 months, there have been a lot of people who have said that the city as an institution, how we know it today, will have changed forever because of the pandemic, because of things like the ability to telecommute. Are you in that camp, or do you think that the city will evolve and continue on as it always has?
I think and I hope that the cities will evolve and continue on. There will certainly be some reduction in use of cities, particularly by suburban residents, people living in suburban areas who are commuting to downtown for work 5 days a week will no longer be doing that. So there will be some change from that. I think in many cities, what will happen is that that space will be used by maybe startup businesses. So businesses that are small, that want to give it a go, that get priced out when rents are too high, but if there's less demand by big commercial renters, then they'll step in. Or that it'll be converted to housing, particularly housing for younger people who don't need that much space, who don't want that much space, who want to be in more of a crowded environment. And so my sense is that in most cities, we'll wind up transforming a little bit of commercial real estate to startup and housing.
A lot of cities over the last, I would say, decade or two decades, have almost tried to transform themselves into playgrounds, especially the city centers. They're playgrounds for other people to come in and enjoy the city, to spend their dollars within the city. Do you think that will change after the pandemic?
The biggest factor there, I think, is going to be do people feel comfortable coming together? So cities are, and particularly cultural events, are the absence of space. So we come together to enjoy each other, to enjoy playing, to enjoy listening, to enjoy eating and socializing. And pandemic says, don't do any of that. So there's a real tension between our human needs to want that and get enjoyment from it and our safety concerns, which say no. So whether we do that will really depend a lot on, is it safe? And what we've seen so far is that, you know, for the past year and a half, it hasn't been safe enough for a lot of that. There have been scattered periods of time, but even still, employment in the travel industry is down, in the hotel industry, in the leisure industry, in the arts industry, all of that is down. And so the sooner we can get over the fear of contracting disease or spreading it to others, then the more we can get back to enjoying the parts of cities which are the bringing people together parts.
Now, in your book, Survival of the City, you spend a lot of time delineating the history of cities and how they responded to epidemics and pandemics, extreme inequality, how cities tend to simultaneously attract and others want to wall off from the city while enjoying all the benefits of the city. What can we learn from that history?
Cities have become battles, if you will, between insiders and outsiders. So they're the insiders, people who've lived there for a long time, people who have houses that they bought cheap that are now worth a lot, people who like the views and the safety and so on. And then the outsiders, people who want to make it, who want to move to the city to get ahead in life. And in some cases, the insiders have done so much. You think about coastal West Coast, California, Oregon, you know, Portland, Seattle, along the East Coast through my own city of Boston and so on. They've done so much to favor the insiders at the expense of the outsiders, that housing prices are unaffordable, that people sort of crowd or they move further and further out and have these hellish commutes. The cities that have done the best at it are the ones that allow a lot more building. Many of them are in the middle of the country, the Nashvilles, the Houstons, the Phoenixes, and so on. And so those are the ways that they reduce tensions, is by making the city be a place where everyone can get ahead, not just where the insiders can, you know, get what they want and the outsiders have to be stuck with much less.
Well, and you also have this great inequality in cities that seem to attract, you know, great capital. You have the insiders that build assets sometimes over generations that allow that inequality to build. And yet those insiders are often dependent on the outsiders for services, for all the amenities that make the city attractive in the first place. And those outsiders really often have nowhere to live.
Yeah, and it's really terrible because, you know, for example, just take one example, Los Angeles, California. People are moving into cities, they're moving to California. You know, it's a high wage, obviously lovely city and so on. And yet the population of Los Angeles is not going up because they're not building any housing. So the house prices are soaring, and so therefore people are moving to the outside counties and communities outside of Los Angeles where they're building more housing and stuff. And that leads to just huge, hugely long commutes and people who are unhappy. And then, you know, folks looking for space, maybe you rent a little storefront in a new neighborhood and then people in that neighborhood feel like their neighborhood is declining. And therefore, you get all these battles like at the margins between neighborhoods, at the edges between neighborhoods, you get all these battles about, you know, whose space is this and who has the right to set up a business here. And so it sort of becomes this zero-sum game, like either I'm going to get it or you're going to get it. Whereas in reality, we need these spaces to work for everyone. And we need the outsiders to be able to come in and say, you know, look, I'm going to open up a shop and I'm going to, you know, and I can live there. My family can live there and we can all do well there, as opposed to, you know, it's essentially impossible for me to do that.
And why are so many cities not open to building more housing and to building new buildings for that matter? What's the hostility there?
To some extent, it's a little bit of environmental. That is, for example, in California, they worry about earthquakes and things. I think to a great extent, it's that a couple of things. One is, you know, whatever views I have are nicer than when there's tall buildings nearby. And also that house prices are really high when there's a lot of demand to live in an area, but there's no supply. So as a insider, I quite like, you know, house prices being high and, you know, the neighborhood being not very crowded and so on. And so that may be good for me personally, but it's a terrible thing for the city because that means people can't live in the city and therefore you can't have a vitality to the city and you can't have the city grow. So on. So it's kind of each individual doing something that is good for themselves, but in aggregate is really bad for all of us.
As we talk about the new book, Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in an Age of Isolation, my guest today is David Cutler, professor of applied economics at Harvard University. He's co-author of the book. We've sort of talked about some of the equity issues surrounding cities. A good part of the book has to do with the pandemic and the fact that cities have always been dealing with pandemics. The first example you use is Athens at the height of its power, involved in a war with Sparta. And they have a pandemic that basically decimates them and helps, you know, is a leading cause of why they lost the war. Cities have always dealt with pandemics. What can we learn from that history in our moment today and probably the moment we're going to see again in 5, 10, 15 years with more and more new animal to human viruses emerging?
Cities have always dealt with them, as you said. ironically, you know, probably the greatest inventions in cities was the ability to control pandemic. So a century ago, when we built sewers and water filtration and chlorination plants and so on, they were big, big items of spending. They were undertaken because rich people knew they were going to have to pay for them, which they did, because rich people said, you know, I've got a stake in poor people being healthier. And so this is the only way to do it, is to make this happen. So one is, we're going to have to rekindle a little bit of that. That is, we're all going to have to worry about the health of even the worst off areas of cities, because those worst off areas make us susceptible to our own illness. So, you know, a city is only as healthy as its least healthy individuals. And so we're going to have to worry about that. I think also we're going to have to address the global issue. So it was okay when what you had is cholera or typhoid fever in Philadelphia, and so Philadelphia had to clean up its water supply, or London had to. But now COVID-19 started in China, and the Delta variant was first noticed in India, and H1N1 came to the U.S. from Mexico, and MERS came from the Middle East, and SARS came from China, and you know, all over the globe, you know, the Spanish flu, the great influenza, actually started in Kansas. So all over the globe, you have possible pandemics. What we talk about in the book is that we should borrow from what has been the most successful international effort to keep the world safe, and that's NATO. So NATO kept the world safe from communist attack for decades. And we ought to apply those same set of principles and set up, we call it sort of a NATO for health. That is something that says, here are the rules by which countries will play. And if you don't play by them, there are consequences. And those consequences can be very severe, because the world's health is at risk. So I think we're going to need something like that to set and enforce the rules of the road, because it's too easy for infectious disease to start anywhere and wind up everywhere.
You know, you used the example of Wuhan and how Chinese authorities shut down Wuhan very quickly. But what wasn't shut down was the international travel system.
That's correct. And in fact, they only shut down Wuhan after the Chinese New Year. And so there was a ton of travel in and out of Wuhan between those times. By that point, it was too late, because the virus had already escaped, and there was no putting it back in the bottle.
I think you get at the heart of what the issue is it's the politics of it is extremely hard, even for an authoritarian country like the Chinese Communist Party. You know, they waited till after the Chinese New Year, which is a major holiday, to put the lockdowns in place.
One of the things, and I keep coming back to NATO, one of the things about NATO is that there are very clear rules. If there's an attack on one, it's an attack on all. And all countries will contribute to defense. And we're not playing political games with NATO. This is, our mission is to prevent attack. And that's what it is. And we will do whatever we need to prevent attack. And I personally have the view that it is a very bad idea to mix politics in with a scientific principle or a principle about governance. And the world has unfortunately done that with pandemic disease. So we had, you know, the World Health Organization catered to China, and it was not tough enough. And with Ebola before that, it sort of catered to West African countries, and it wasn't tough enough. And that doesn't work. When the world's health is at danger, you must do what you need to do scientifically and from a public health perspective to keep people safe. And so that's partly why we focus on these sort of technical agencies and say we have to agree to invest some authority in the technical agencies, not to run everything, but to give them a mission. Your mission is to prevent world outbreak. Now figure out how you need to do that.
Well, you know, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, I think a lot of people prior to this pandemic thought of that agency, at least for the U.S., as being that sort of agency immune to politics. But, you know, it doesn't matter what your political viewpoint is. I think if you look at the performance of the CDC, you can say, no, it's had political pressures. The WHO certainly had political pressures. What a NATO for health, because it's going to be funded by governments. Won't it be prone to the same political pressures?
So it's always possible about those things. The WHO, in part because its funding is always so tenuous, has felt that need. And one of the things about agencies that are stronger is that their funding is more secured. So they don't have to always say, well, if at this moment I say something not nice about this country, am I going to lose my ability to do all these really good things that I'm doing? So there's always that tension, but we have had, like, for example, you know, in the U.S. with our Medicare program and our Social Security program, flaws that they have, they're focused on their mission, which is to make sure that elderly people have cash support and medical care needs taken care of. And that's because their funding tends to be more secured. So I think that it's not inevitable that the politics intrudes. It's really more about how we do it. Not to say that they get supreme rights over things, because neither Social Security nor Medicare nor NATO does, but just that they don't have to worry that every single decision is going to affect their budget in that way.
I noticed that argument comes up a number of times in your book, whether it's on inequality, on policing, that basically stronger governmental institutions basically are able to make better decision because they're feeling more secure in the institution and how it is thought of within its constituency. Is there something to that?
I think there is. But it's also the case that if you look, for example, at why was the virus in Wuhan not contained in Wuhan, in part it was because the leaders in Wuhan were afraid of telling their higher-ups what was going on, because they knew they'd be punished for it. So whatever authoritarian principles do well when you need to get something done, don't do well when you get punished for bringing things up. It's a little bit like, I think of it a little bit like, maybe, I'm not sure if this is the right example, but the U.S. Army, where the political leaders lay out the mission, and then they say to the armed services, now you figure out how to get this done. So your job is to get this done the best way, and my job is to help tell you what is the right thing to do. And that kind of division is probably the most successful.
My guest today is David Cutler. He's professor of applied economics at Harvard University, and he and his co-author and colleague at Harvard, Edward Glaser, are the authors of The Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in an Age of Isolation. It's published by Penguin. Well, the book does spend a lot of time on pandemic, and we can talk a little bit more about that a little later when we talk about some of your recommendations. It also gets into the extreme inequality in our cities and how this pandemic has laid raw some of those inequalities in policing, in education. Do you agree that this pandemic has unmasked some of those very glaring problems which were there for all to see, but this has certainly pulled the scab off the wound, a lot of wounds that are there within the city?
I certainly agree with that the pandemic has pulled the scab off. Many of them were festering even before. So, for example, issues of police brutality and racism in the public sector. Some were always simmering a little below the surface, issues of gentrification, battles over gentrification and schools and so on. And all of them are being brought forward. And populations are saying, you know, we need to deal with COVID, but we also need to deal with these other issues as well. In fact, they're not, you can't even really separate them. And so across the country, across the world, you're seeing cities say, okay, I now realize I have to address this. The population is, I think, in a very activist mood. That is, it really wants to take on some of these. That is great because it means that, you know, that people's interests are there and that the will is there. It can be difficult, though, because often that requires money that cities don't have, and it requires actions that may create a lot of conflict. So the key for a lot of cities is going to be, how do you manage the desire of people to get things done on everybody's part, to get things done with the constraints that people can leave, and businesses will think about leaving, and richer people will think about leaving, and the middle class will think about leaving, and so on. So it's going to put cities in a very precarious situation.
Yeah, I think that's you know, if it's just raising local taxes, I think you do see a lot of flight from the cities. New York certainly had it in the 80s, when you know people flocked to Connecticut and New Jersey. They still do when tax rates go up. So how do you begin to make a city more affordable for ordinary people when a lot of the the work that can do that requires tax dollars that I guess the insiders, if you will, don't want to foot the bill for.
Yeah, so some of it does not require dollars. So we were talking about building. And building does not require public dollars. It requires typically the public sector to lighten up on the regulations that are prohibiting some of it. So that's an obvious place to start, and that will have an immediate impact on rents and housing prices for people who are looking to move into a city. In other cases, I think you have to do it collaboratively. So, and you have to get people to buy into what's going to happen. So you say, look, police have two goals. One goal is community safety, and another goal is respecting the civil rights of everyone. And we, as a society, have gone too far in terms of the safety, and we've tolerated way too much in terms of the disrespecting the civil rights of people. So we need to rebalance that. So here's how we're going to do this. We're going to tell police that not to do less of one, but to do more of the other. So we want both of these to happen. That's going to require more money, but you can also set targets. So you can say, here's how this money is going to show up. It's going to show up as people feeling more secure and as more people being able to be out and comfortable. And that's going to help businesses in the following way, and it's going to help neighborhoods in the following way. So it's trying to be very specific about what you want and saying, if you're with me on this, this is what we can get. I'm not just going to tax you and not tell you where it's going. We're going to agree on where it's going, and we're all going to then get this share in the benefits of it.
Yeah, I think for a lot of the things you write about, whether it be public health or a better criminal justice system, it's not about defunding. It's about adding more money, but targeted money, so that there is accountability put in place. So give me some ideas about creating this more effective and balanced criminal justice system.
There are a couple of keys to it. One of them starts with measurement, which is we need to measure what our police are doing and our criminal justice system as a whole is doing and how well it's working. So, for example, what we've measured and graded police by for the past couple of decades is just crime rates. So anything you can do to drive down crime rates is seen as successful for the community, independent of how that affects those on the other end, that is those who are then the results of interaction with police. So you need to start by measuring. Second, you then need to figure out how to get the incentives right. So you need to say to the police department, you know, to the criminal justice system, here's what we want to happen. We want both safety and we want everybody to be treated well. And so we're going to measure it, and we're going to, as you said, we're going to put more money in. But now what we need from you is to help us with how are we going to ensure that that gives what we need. And then third, I think we need to have the modesty, the humility to say we may not know all the answers now. So we're going to start on something, and if that's successful, great, and we'll keep doing that. And if it's not as successful as we think, we're going to try something different because we're just going to learn as we go along. Through those, we can get certainly much closer to where we want to be.
Now, I was struck by something I read over the weekend, which was that, you know, despite the rhetoric to the contrary, other than a spike in murders, once again, the overall crime rate in the United States went down over the last year. This has been a long-term trend of declining crime rates.
Yeah, absolutely. So there has been a very long-term trend, very salutary trend in terms of declining crime rates. Much of it has been for good things, that is, police have gotten smarter in terms of figuring out how to use technology and so on to figure out where crimes are and how to catch people and so on. And part of it is, unfortunately, because, you know, certain people's civil rights have not been fully respected in doing that. And what we need to do is we need to have both of those, not one or the other, not say let's have more crime but respect more rights or whatever, but we need to do both. And so that's really what we're going to have to do, and we're going to have to work together to make both of those happen, not just tilt the pendulum one way or the other.
I learned a few new facts in the book, your book, Survival of the City. One was on vaccine production, and one of your recommendations is we shrink the time from conception to distribution. And I was really struck by something else that you mentioned throughout the book, that a lot of our debates over how to react during this pandemic is the fact that COVID is not the most lethal pandemic we've ever seen. You know, it's more lethal than average flu or even a novel flu or on a par with a novel flu maybe. But it's not like cholera or smallpox or anything like that. And that has led to debates over the right approach. And you said, if this was more lethal, there would have been no debates. But I was really struck by the idea that this is the fact that I learned that in the vaccine production, we had a vaccine designed in about 2 days after the genome was released. It took about 25 days to produce, and the rest of the time until the vaccine was approved for use in the United States was spent on testing. You say we really need to shrink the time from conception to distribution. Is that possible?
It is possible. And, you know, to the extent that things went well, probably the biggest success item of COVID was getting vaccines out in under a year, and that was totally unheard of. We could, and there was a lot of back and forth, you know, every time a company had a question, it could call the FDA and get an answer, you know, in minutes as opposed to months. But that much said, there were things that took longer than they ought to have, and the testing is part of that. It's something that can happen quicker. You can, you know, it's how quickly can you enroll people? How quickly can you get the results and so on? Sometimes you may be sufficiently sure that even before full results are in, you can go ahead and do, you know, test vaccination of high-risk people and things. So that step is probably in this process the step that was the slowest that we should try to speed up. But in general, it was enormously successful because so many resources were brought to bear in a coordinated way. That was, we just won't tolerate delay on this.
Yeah. So back to our original question of the survival of the city. What's your long-term prognosis? Is it optimistic, pessimistic, or are you ambivalent?
I tend to be optimistic. And so the benefits of cities are just too high to think they will go away. But we're going to have to address pandemic disease. We're going to have to address the worldwide spread of pandemic disease. And it's going to, and the next bit is going to be rocky because we're going to have to figure out how to run our cities, our country, our world system better. And it's going to require, we're in a different era. We're in an era of pandemic disease. And until we come to grips with that, it's going to have ups and downs.
Well, we've been through, I don't know how many, there's been SARS, there's been an Ebola breakout, there's been MERS, there have been swine flus, and now COVID. It seems like we're going to see more novel pathogens down the road.
We will, until we get our act together, until we say these are the rules and these are how we're going to prevent them and how we're going to catch them early and how we're going to respond to them early. And until we do that, it's, you know, every couple of years, we're going to be in a situation where we're going to be worried about another pandemic.
David Cutler, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you so much.
David Cutler is a professor of applied economics at Harvard University. He and his co-author and Harvard colleague, Edward Glaser, are the author of Survival of the City, Living and Thriving in an Age of Isolation. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.